My lecture yesterday on banking, a big central focus of fractional reserve banking is the concept of the money multiplier. It's a pretty well, it's originally an Austrian idea, actually, or Herbert Davenport, Austrian or not, Joe?
Yeah.
On a scale of 1 to 10?
8.
8, yeah, pretty, so I mean, it's an Austrian idea. The mainstream uses it. I mean, probably if you want the best modern look at the money multiplier, go to just a regular mainstream textbook. It'll give you a pretty good idea of how the multiplier works in a modern setting. And then over the years of having to teach it, there are certain difficulties that have arisen for me in trying to teach it to undergrads, or there's new types of questions that crop up, and they mostly have to do with new forms of banking regulation and new types of monetary policies. And so what I wanted to do was, I guess to put it that way, my original motivation was just to change the money multiplier in some way, to update it to the way that central banking actually works today. So just to start, we're going to have to go through some well-trod paths just to do a quick review. So we'll start by just defining the money supply in the conventional, the M1 way of currency and deposits, good enough. And then we'll define the base money supply controlled by the central bank in the conventional way of just currency plus reserves. And of course, if you just take the ratio of those two, you get the right-hand side. Here I just broke up for discussion reserves into required bank reserves plus excess reserves. Of course, excess reserves are kind of still a big topic to talk about. And then you can just multiply throughout on the right-hand side by 1 over your deposit base to end up with the money multiplier, which is in the square brackets. And so when you talk to, well, in my lecture, I guess I would have done this. If you assume that excess reserves are zero, which is pretty good assumption under, you know, most normal banking conditions, or actually it was a good assumption throughout all of modern history until 2008. You see that the money multiplier is only determined by the public's demand to hold currency relative to deposits, and by the banking system's need to hold reserves, and of course that is set by regulation, generally by the central bank. And then you go through the normal steps. As the reserve ratio falls to zero, the money multiplier is going to go to infinity. And in the case where you have a reserve ratio of 100%, you just have a full reserve bank and a money multiplier equal to 1. So we can just use that money multiplier to describe the banking system's ability to create deposits and then to affect the money supply. Okay, so that's the fairly standard theory, which everybody's more or less aware of. But then as you teach this, there's some problems. And even just in the research, there's some problems with this. And one of the biggest problems that came up is this debate that goes on right now about, which you can phrase as being the reserves first theory of the multiplier versus the loans first theory of the multiplier. And this especially has gained traction since 2004. The Bank of England published what was a very popular paper arguing that the money multiplier is not really, it's not applicable any longer. And the reason why they argue this is that once upon a time, it's true that banks used to get reserves, or central banks would create reserves and sell them to banks, and then banks would lend out against those reserves. And that's the process that I went over yesterday in my lecture on banking. But today, banks don't do that. Banks just issue loans. And then when they need reserves to get up to any required reserve ratio, they just go to the central bank and ask for them on demand. And of course, especially right now, central banks are just willing to fulfill all of these demand for reserves. And so this school, and it's called the endogenous monetary school, they look at the money multiplier and they say, well, it's got the causality reversed. It's not that banks ask for reserves and then issue loans against them. It's that banks just go ahead and issue loans, and then they ask for reserves from the central bank. And at first I said, well, this criticism is a little bit misplaced, because of course the money multiplier, it's just an equation, right? So it's not that it's right or wrong. If you have a criticism of it, it must be about the causal factors, the direction that the variables are affecting one another, not with the actual multiplier itself. Yet when you read endogenous monetary theories, they actually have a problem with this money multiplier as an equation. So it seems they don't even think it's applicable at all. And so I used to dismiss them out of hand. And then as time went by, I became a little bit more sympathetic to them. Because it is true, especially right now when interest rates are very low, that central banks are fully accommodating of any reserve demand that a private bank has. And it's especially true right now if you look at credit facilities offered by banks. All of us have a line of credit with our bank through our bank account. The bank just automatically says it's going to issue us credit. It doesn't worry about any reserves that it has ahead of time. If you happen to use your line of credit and the bank needs reserves, it's going to go to the central bank and ask for it. It's going to go and borrow from another bank, something like that. But it's already issued you the loan, or it's already authorized the loan to you. So I'm somewhat sympathetic to this view, this endogenous monetary view, that the banks just issue loans and then they turn around and ask for reserves after the fact. Now, I said I'm sympathetic to it right now because, of course, there is a constraint. The central bank wouldn't have to just issue reserves if it doesn't want to. It just so happens that right now central banks are very accommodating. But it's a valid criticism within this time period, I think. And then there's this whole issue when you teach the money multiplier, the control of the money supply falls mainly through the central bank's control of the reserve ratio. But then as you go through, you say, well, the central bank never really changes the required reserve ratio, and most of the time banks don't hold excess reserves. So I almost have this empty feeling after I teach it, because you go through this whole theory where you say changes to the reserve ratio affect the money multiplier, but then you tell students that in practice the reserve ratio never really gets changed and banks don't hold excess reserves. So then the only thing that changes the money supply is any change in base money. But then if that's true, why go through all the work to teach the money multiplier? Because it doesn't really change. And in any case, then you get to jurisdictions. I mean, in the States, at least there's a reserve ratio. So you can discuss about, there's a required reserve ratio. So you can discuss this. But in all sorts of jurisdictions, pretty much every Anglo country, which is not America, there's no required reserve ratios, right? Like in Canada, the UK, Australia, etc. No bank is obliged to hold any reserves by law. They voluntarily do. So they have excess reserves that basically serve the same purpose. But when you teach it to students, it's a little bit foggy how this reserve ratio actually works in purpose, given that the central banks in many jurisdictions don't actually set one. And that only begs the question then of what it is that central banks actually do. So now in banking regulation, there's been a shift since the very late 1980s, since the Basel regulations came in force in 1988, that banks are no longer primarily regulated through the liquidity ratios and through their being forced to hold reserves. Now they're much more regulated through their use of capital. And in Europe, there's no real binding reserve ratio within the euro system of banks that banks have to maintain, but they have to maintain strict capital requirements. And starting this year, there was a shift after, of course, the financial crisis in 2008. There was a new set of Basel requirements, Basel III. The states didn't really sign on until, well, they'd signed on but not implemented them. But starting this year is the first year that American banks have started implementing the Basel capital requirements. And so we see this shift happening where on the regulatory sphere, banks don't have to hold reserves, or at least that's not the primary regulation that they face anymore. They're more capital constrained. And there's a related issue with this, by the way, and it is that in the crisis, if you think about a bank which faces a liquidity problem, like it lacks reserves, the central bank can always step in and supply reserves. That's not really such a big problem, right? But banks that are capital constrained, which is insolvent banks, the central bank can't always step in and just inject capital into them. That's very difficult. A, it's difficult politically. B, it's difficult economically. And so that's one of the motivations towards shifting away from liquidity ratios towards capital requirements, because it's something that the central bank can't actually supply on demand. And so over the years, as I've thought more and more about the money multiplier, I've kind of had these criticisms in the back of my mind, and I've been searching for a way to really update it. And just to maybe set things in context here, the money multiplier is important. It's not that it's unimportant or non-applicable, like endogenous monetary theorists think. Like in Rothbard's America's Great Depression, it takes a pretty central role. And especially this, you know, like if you were to ask me, the main contribution that he has in there, or one of the main contributions, is the attention that he gives to shifting between accounts or deposits with higher reserve ratios, and of course deposits that have lower reserve ratios demand to time deposits, and looking at how those shifts reduced the demand that banks had for reserves, increased the money multiplier, increased the money supply. So, of course, the money multiplier and its emphasis on reserves was important in a historical point of view, but it's somewhat less important today. It was useful once upon a time, but it's still useful, but less so today. And then I was actually highly influenced by this paper of yours, Joe, which I think is one of your best, by the way. I'm not just saying that. I won't get into your worst ones, but this one's one of your best. Because you take the best of the worst. You take a tautology, the equation of exchange, which is just a tautology. It's not right or wrong. And it's the exact same thing as the money multiplier. It's just a tautology, right? It's not right or wrong. And then you give attention to the causality, which doesn't really get which variables affect other variables, because that gets grazed over. The equation of exchange gets used every day, constantly, but there's very little attention given to causality. And in particular, if you teach macro, this is one of my peeves, you change the money supply, and then the right-hand side just changes. The causality runs from, it's just goes from left to right, so to speak, or implicitly that's what people assume. And in Joe's simple model of the theory of money prices, he goes through to say, yes, you can change the supply of money, but really it affects your preferences, the quantities of goods which are bought and sold, and it's through that change to Q that the other variables change. So you change the causality around from the left-hand side to the right-hand side and give attention to that. And that is, I think, one of the most important little papers that you could write, just giving attention to the causal chain of events that take place in tautological expressions or equations. And of course, in mainstream econ, when you throw this up, that chain of causality is much less important. You just have a series of equations which you just have to solve simultaneously. And you don't really have to give so much attention to the flow of causality, but of course it's there in the background and it should be the first question that you really answer. So this paper that Joe had really motivated me to give attention to which way causality runs within tautological statements. Not just use the statement, but really tease out the implications of it. So that's what I wanted to do with the money multiplier. And of course, that's what the debate is with endogenous monetary theory. Does causality run from reserves to loans, or does causality run from loans to reserves? So then, in looking at the money multiplier, I was a little bit motivated as well by a thought that I've had in the back of my mind, which is, and I teach mainstream econ primarily, and in mainstream econ, there's all sorts of ideas that emerged from the Austrians that the mainstream adopted but didn't really adopt in the exact same way, or they simplified things. And so you have some theories which are broadly similar, but then there's some important differences. The money multiplier is a really good case in point. Just going through a brief history in it, Mises in the theory of money and credit, he develops, not in very formal terms, but he develops the nub and the kernel of the money multiplier process, the fractional reserve process. So he's probably the great-great-grandfather, I suppose, of this general idea. But it's Herbert Davenport in 1913 who really, I think, solidifies in much more formal, concrete terms what it is that banks are actually doing. And Davenport's actually interesting because if you read him, he is not a reserves-first theorist. He's a loans-first theorist, that banks are issuing loans and creating deposits in that way. So he's actually very much in line with this endogenous monetary theory, which is popular today, this idea that banks just issue loans and then ask for reserves after the fact. And then, of course, the idea of the money multiplier really got popularized by Chester Phillips' book Bank Credit, where he really lays out explicitly what this actual process is through which banks are able to create deposits and affect the money supply. So the money multiplier itself is a thoroughly Austrian idea at its emergence. It gets adopted by the mainstream. Then the way that the mainstream uses it today hasn't really updated with the times. And one of the things that attracted me to Austrian economics initially, I came from finance, was that it was a very real way of looking at economics. It was consistent with what I saw in financial markets, and it was not... it's high-level theory, but it's not abstract theory that you can't relate to anything else. The money multiplier is a really good case in point. In the early part of the 20th century, you can see exactly how this works with the emphasis on reserves. Now, like I say, it's a little bit strained to understand what role reserves play in the money creation process, so I wanted to really take it and update it in a thoroughly Austrian way to show how it functions, because it still must be important, and it's a tautology, so it must be correct. So before I go into that, I just wanted to throw up a couple charts here showing the evolution of the commercial banking system in the state. So this is the asset side of the consolidated balance sheet of all the commercial banks in the states. I've broken up assets into three categories. The first is the cash assets. Cash assets are cash or cash equivalents. So required reserves, which are almost non-existent, right? It's this blue bar at the bottom, non-existent and doesn't really change over, we've got a 20-year view on things here. We've got excess reserves, which is kind of the sexy story that emerged after the crisis. So banks loading up with excess reserves, peaking out in 2014, and now we're going through this process where we're gradually shedding off reserves. There's some other cash assets. Those are government bonds primarily. Short maturity government bonds. And one of the important shifts that we've seen is that the commercial banking system holds next to none of these today. They're preferring to hold on to reserves. Of course, reserve balances are earning interest at the Fed, the same, they're really almost perfect substitutes for these government bonds. So we see the commercial banking system divesting itself of these other cash assets, these government bonds. Then we get into bank credit. This is loans that are extended by the banking system. Of course, if you go back 20 years and even earlier, this is the lion's share, as it is today, of all bank assets, except you can see that they're much less important than they were once upon a time. And especially as we saw the growth in excess reserves, that displaced credit which was being issued by the commercial banking system, and now it's increasing a little bit and doing a reverse displacement of those excess reserves. And then the last thing that we have are other assets. Property, primarily, things like that, or trading assets. And we can see that also there's been a little bit of a shift where they're less important than they used to be as well. So we've got some compositional shifts that are taking place on the asset side of the commercial banking system's balance sheet. And by the way, the money multiplier, with its emphasis on reserve ratios, is an asset look at the banking system. It only concerns itself with bank assets, the primary bank asset being the reserves that the banks are forced to hold on to or voluntarily hold on to. So I like to divide up the money multiplier into this asset approach versus a liability approach, which we're going to do a little bit later. And then just to take a look, this is a very stylized look at the commercial banking system's liability side of its balance sheet in the States. So banks are financed primarily through deposits. That's no big surprise. Then they also do some borrowing on the loans market. That's these other liabilities. And then they're also financed by capital, shareholder, retained earnings, et cetera, et cetera. And here we see some interesting shifts over the last 20 years. The one interesting shift that you see is that there's been a small increase in their dependence on the deposit base as a financing source. And by financing source, I mean they use deposits to fund the asset side of their balance sheet. But then more importantly, there's been a pretty gradual increase and a fairly sharp increase during the crisis in the banking system's reliance on capital as a funding source. And there's a bit of a tug of war going on here, where these other liabilities, the traditional bank borrowing, is being displaced by an increased reliance on bank capital and a small increase in reliance on the deposit base. So we see these shifts that are taking place. They don't look like they're very significant, but you'll see in a moment, I'm going to give you a different picture on these. They're larger shifts than you might see. But maybe something that stands out in your mind right here is that during the crisis, there is this very large increase in reliance on bank capital for funding, at least in the commercial banking system. So now let's get to it and revise the multiplier. So go through the conventional steps. You define money in the conventional way and base money in the conventional way as well. And then what I want to do is look at the bank's balance sheet, because while base money includes total reserves that banks hold, of course, total reserves that banks hold is also one of the primary components of the asset side of their balance sheet. And of course, before I move on, I'll just explain. So I've broken up their assets into their required reserves, excess reserves. This is bank credit, M, because it's primarily mortgages. And I didn't want to use B or C because they're already taken, right? So that's just bank credit or mortgages. And then this is just other assets that the commercial banks are holding on to. And then the commercial banking system's balance sheet, its assets have to be equal to its liabilities. Its liabilities are composed of deposits, other liabilities. These are loans that they're borrowing. Required capital. Now we can talk of required capital in the American banking system because there are very formal capital requirements. You couldn't if you went back in time. And then, of course, there's excess capital that banks can choose to hold in excess if they choose. And so what I'm going to do in the next step, I'm not going to show you all the steps, but basically all I'm doing is deriving the money multiplier by substituting out total reserves for these total reserves here. And what I want to do, since our assets are equal to our liabilities, is substitute in the liabilities that the bank holds, and especially the capital portion of the liabilities. And, before I do that, I'll just show you what the actual consolidated balance sheet looks like. So here, I've got this categorized according to the same variables we just looked at. So required reserves are 190 billion right now. Excess reserves are down compared to where they used to be, but still almost 2 trillion. Bank credit, these mortgages extended, are almost 13 trillion. And then the other assets, which the banking system holds, are about 1.9 trillion for total assets of about 17 trillion, right? And those assets are backed by the liabilities that fund them. The liabilities are mostly the deposit base. So 1.3 trillion worth of regulatory capital right now, 500 billion worth of excess capital, and then a small amount of other liabilities, of borrowings that banks have. So that's just the consolidated balance sheet in number terms for you. And also just to remind you what these variables actually mean. So you go on, and when you revise the money multiplier, you end up with a term like this, which looks somewhat similar to the conventional money multiplier, except it's got a whole bunch of additional terms in it, so we'll just go through it. We'll start on the right-hand side, actually. We've got this M over D, which is the ratio of bank extended credit to its deposit base, like mortgages to its deposit base. You've got the capital ratios coming up to the four here. You've got the difference between their other assets and other liabilities and other assets, again, relative to its deposit base. And this is the exact same money multiplier as the initial one. It's just stated in terms of different variables. So when you fill all these numbers in, you get the exact same number. We're just trying to give attention to different variables. And if you go through the steps, of course, here the money multiplier has four different factors that would cause it to increase or decrease. The first is the change in currency holding relative to deposits. This is consistent, same direction as what we had in the original money multiplier. So people hold less currency, deposit more, money multiplier increases. If capital ratios decrease, either required or excess, that's going to cause the money multiplier to go up. If our other liabilities relative to assets decrease, that will cause the money multiplier to go up. And then if the bank issues a greater amount of credit, mortgages in this case relative to deposits, that would cause the multiplier to go up. So that's really no surprises, except it's introducing, it's phrasing the multiplier in terms of a different set of variables. So then we see that the money multiplier is determined by five different variables, right? The currency deposit ratio, other assets relative to other liabilities, our two capital ratios, and bank credit relative to deposits. So why don't we just go through and see how these variables have evolved over time. Oh, actually, I guess before I do that, I should point out that one of the key discussions when you talk about the money multiplier is who actually controls it. And in conventional circles, when you teach the money multiplier, you say, okay, well, the money holding public determines how much currency they want to hold, and they affect the money multiplier in that way. The central bank or the regulatory agency determines how many required reserves the banking system has to hold, so they have some control over that. Banks have control over excess reserves. So we have three different levels of control that we can look at. Here we have three different levels of control as well, except they differ somewhat. So the public still controls their ratio of currency to deposits. The regulatory regime controls the supply of base money, but now they don't control the reserve ratio, they control regulatory capital. And then finally, the banking system itself, instead of just controlling excess reserves, here they control excess capital, the ratio of bank credit or mortgages extended relative to deposits, and then this ratio of other liabilities and assets. So we've got three new components that banks control, one new component that the regulatory regime controls as well. So the interesting thing, this is just how the money multiplier, the M1 money multiplier, has evolved since the mid-70s. And the interesting thing was that in the crisis, one of the most talked about elements of it was that the money multiplier completely broke down. And you could see that, of course, because the Federal Reserve or all central banks were pumping in base money. Money supply wasn't budging by much, and the reason is that the money multiplier is also has fallen significantly. And so As we go forward here, what I really want to give attention to is what's causing this drop off in the multiplier. So the conventional explanation is, oh, banks just load up with excess reserves, which is true, of course. And this one, this excess reserve ratio looks a little bit strange because it's only at its peak 25%. It's because I'm using the full deposit base, not just the demand deposit base. So that's why it's lower than would otherwise be the case. But still, you can understand that, yes, excess reserves go up, and so that causes the money multiplier to decrease. And now the money multiplier is edging a little bit higher. It must be caused by banks shedding their excess reserves. Of course, that's also true. But what you really have to question is, how much are banks actually targeting this excess reserve level, or how much of it is just residual of other things that they actually are targeting? So what else could they be targeting? Well, in the conventional view, as in this revised view, you have this currency deposit ratio. For the most part, it's actually not very volatile, right? It more or less shifts between 10 and 14%. So that's really not so significant compared to some of the other variables we're going to see. And of course, we can see the breakdown of it leading up to the crisis and the increase that we've had since then. But probably this is stable enough, give or take, that it's not significantly affecting the money multiplier. There must be something else at stake. Okay, so when we revise it, one of the terms that we had was banks' other liabilities less their other assets relative to deposits. And here we can see that this is actually quite a volatile variable. It's small in absolute magnitude, by the way, right? It makes up less than 5% of the bank's balance sheet. But the shift is fairly significant once you take it as a ratio of deposits. And of course, up until the mid-1980s, this ratio was negative, implying that banks were holding on to more other assets than they had liabilities. That's kind of the direction that we're heading here in more recent years, but it's still positive. But I wanted to point out how volatile that actually is. Now, that is probably not so important because banks are not targeting this ratio. This is just a residual of something else that banks are doing. So what is it that banks are actually trying to target? Well, they could be targeting the amount of credit that they're issuing, relative to their deposit base. So this is, you can think of bank credit as the total supply of mortgages issued by the bank. Of course, there's other components to it. And it hovers around 1 to about 1.2, give or take, dropped throughout the crisis, and now it's been fairly stable around 1 right now, which you could interpret as saying 100% of bank credit extended is financed through deposits. Strictly speaking, that's not true because there's also other borrowings and capital, but that's maybe the easiest way to think about it. And then we get into my favorite one, just because it's volatile and because it's more important, and this is the capital ratio that banks have. So this is the percentage of the deposit base which is being financed, this is the amount of capital taken as a percentage of the deposit base. It's fairly volatile over the years, especially we can see during the crisis that there's a really sharp increase in banks changing their financing needs from being deposit-based to being capital-based. You can understand that in the crisis because one of the bank's primary problems with using deposits to finance itself is that they're demandable and people can ask for them. And maybe we won't have enough liquid reserves to honor that. But the problem with focusing on that is, as long as the bank has capital and as long as it's solvent, it can always go and borrow money to satisfy its reserve requirements, either from the central bank or another bank. And so throughout the crisis, we see banks increasing quickly their capital ratios, their reliance on capital as a funding source. More lately, they've been divesting themselves from it. But then at the same time, starting at the end of this series, we are starting to enforce capital ratios in line with the Basel requirements, which we'll get to in a moment. So then what I wanted to show you was just how this change in the capital deposit ratio, given that it's a component of the money multiplier, how it actually affects the money multiplier. So from this low point right here of banks only holding 6.5% of their deposit base in the form of capital, to this peak here in 2010, kind of the worst of the crisis, where banks were about 17% of their deposit base in the form of capital. Ceteris paribus, just that increase in capital caused the money multiplier to almost halve. So this is an illustration of how the money multiplier is actually affected by changes to capital structure, or the capital weighting on the bank's liability side of its balance sheet, and then how that filters through to the money supply. Now, in banking regulation today, banks don't have to hold capital against deposits because, of course, that doesn't really mean anything. Capital and deposits are just competing liabilities on the bank's balance sheet. But in the Basel regulations, the requirement is that they have to hold a tier one capital amount against their risk-weighted asset base. The Fed doesn't actually report what this is, so I had to construct it as best I could. The Basel III requirement is that they need to hold, banks need to hold 8% of their total of their risk-weighted asset base in the form of Tier 1 capital. Then they also have to hold a buffer of 2.5%. In the States, the buffer of 2.5% is not enforced. It is in lots of other countries. And if you take that together, it gives you a capital requirement of 10.5%, which, by the way, right now is about what banks are targeting. Of course, the 2.5 buffer is not applicable right now, so really American banks only need to hold 8%. But it seems as though they're acting as though the buffer is necessary or perhaps will be enforced eventually. So I just wanted to show you how banks have actually responded to the introduction. If you look at this shoring up in capital here in the crisis, partly I would say it's to divest themselves of deposits as a source of funding, but also in preparation of coming Basel capital requirements. So then I thought, just to round this out a little bit, what I wanted to do was compare the conventional limits on, or limit values, I guess you can call them, on the reserve ratio and its effect on the money multiplier. Compare that with what the similar limits would look like with capital requirements. So when you teach about the money multiplier and you focus on the reserve ratio, you focus on two particular limit values, right? The first limit value that's of interest is what happens when banks hold a 0% reserve ratio. Of course, when reserves fall to zero, the money multiplier goes to infinity. And then the second one, which is of interest, is what happens if banks hold 100% reserves. That's a full reserve banking system. In that case, of course, the money multiplier is equal to one. And so you end up with a money multiplier that's always somewhere between one and infinity, right? Depending on how many reserves a bank actually holds. So now that we're going to focus on capital, how does that story change? So we've got case one. Well, what happens if the bank decides to hold no capital against its deposit base, right? Which you can think of as being an analogous case to a bank holding no reserves against its deposit base in a way. Okay, so if the capital deposit ratio equals zero, this is what we get for the money multiplier. It's a little bit more complicated, of course, because we have a lot more terms in the denominator, but this is what it simplifies down to. Well, there's not too much that we can really do with it, at least that's very simple, except if you remember when I showed those graphs a moment ago, bank credit to deposits right now is about one, and it doesn't vary all that much, and it's been about one for the last 35 years. So why don't we just assume that it is equal to one to see what happens? And if you assume that that bank credit to deposit ratio is stable around one, the money multiplier simplifies down to this term. And of course then, if banks are holding no capital, the money multiplier is only determined by the public's demand to hold currency, and you end up with two cases. If the public demands to hold no currency, the money multiplier tends to infinity. By the way, that's the exact same case as you'd have as a bank held no reserves. Or if the bank held all of their money in the form of currency and nothing in deposits, then the multiplier would be equal to one. That's also quite similar to what you get with the reserve ratio approach. Case two is maybe less interesting, but it simplifies down into something which is kind of neat. This is what happens if the bank's liability side of its balance sheet is equally balanced between capital and deposits, which is to say, a bank could in theory be holding no reserves whatsoever, and it's just holding a full amount of capital to back its deposit base. So if a depositor ever came and asked for money back, they would just have to sell off capital, or they would borrow against their capital base in order to come up with liquid reserves. So if that were the case, the money multiplier turns to this term here. Again, following that conventional assumption that I used previously, that the bank credit to deposit ratio is empirically more or less stable around one and is equal to one right now. And the money multiplier, of course, just simplifies down to one. In which case, if the bank's liability side of its balance sheet is equally balanced between capital and deposits, and this M over D ratio is equal to one, the bank has no effect over the total supply of money, which is an interesting result. And then the third case, which is similar to what you would see in reserve ratio analysis, is what happens if the capital deposit ratio tends to infinity? What does that even mean? That just means that the bank is financing itself completely through capital and not through deposits, right? Because the liability side of the balance sheet is either capital or deposits. In which case, if the bank was not accepting deposits, the money multiplier actually tends to zero. So then when we compare them, here in this table, when you go down this column, these are just the three different cases and the values that the reserve ratio is actually taking, and then the resultant money multiplier through those three cases. So if banks hold no reserves, the money multiplier is infinity. If banks are 100% reserved, the money multiplier is equal to 1. If banks were holding no deposits, then the multiplier would be equal to 0. That's under the conventional analysis. And then the column on the right, you can see how similar my analysis is, but it phrases it in different terms. If the capital ratio is set equal to 0, dependent on the currency to deposit ratio, you get a money multiplier between 1 and infinity. In the case where capital and deposits are equally balanced, you end up with a money multiplier equal to 1. In the case where the bank is completely financed through capital and not through deposits, you end up with a money multiplier equal to 0. So I only throw this up here to show that you get some conventional results, but you get to focus on some variables which are actually controlled by the banking system and especially the regulatory regime instead of focusing on reserves. So it's a different spin on a conventional story. And so I want to conclude just by going through a list of advantages that this approach has. So the first is, from my point of view, I originally developed it as a pedagogical tool. What do you say to students when you teach the money multiplier and somebody says, yeah, but banks aren't forced to hold reserves, so what happens to the money multiplier then? What happens in regimes where there's no required reserve ratio? Or why go through all this work if there exist regimes where there's no required reserve ratio? So in those cases, I developed it to focus on bank capital, which is important and which is a central aspect, increasingly so, of the regulatory landscape. And in particular, I wanted to really focus on bank liabilities instead of bank assets. The assets, of course, is where you get into the reserve approach of things. The liability side of the balance sheet includes capital. And so that was where I wanted to shift attention, not to banks targeting a composition on their asset side of their balance sheet, although they're doing that. But they're more so targeting a liability structure on their balance sheet. And in particular, they're doing it by choosing how they want to be funded. Do they want to fund their lending operations through deposits, as was conventionally the case, or do they want to fund their lending operations through capital? The third advantage in this approach is that it allows you to actually understand new banking regulations. Like in Europe, liquidity regulations within the European system of central banks, the Basel regulations don't really focus on liquidity ratios all that much, but they focus very centrally on capital ratios. And so I wanted to make that apparent and especially show in the mainstream right now, by the way, there's a bit of a dissonance going on. The dissonance is that in the literature on banking regulation, there's a lot of attention given to capital ratios and its effect on banking stability, solvency, et cetera, et cetera. But then in terms of the actual, in monetary economics, there's almost no literature on the effect of banking regulation and capital requirements on the money supply. It's a big lacuna when you look in the research. The fourth advantage I had was that, in my mind, it corrects for the causality. Again, when I say correct for the causality, there's a debate going on, reserves first or loans first. And as the case may be, especially near the zero bound, and especially since the crisis, banks have just been issuing loans and then asking for reserves after the fact. So this allows one to actually see which way the causality runs. If they're not so concerned with maintaining a certain reserve level, at least we can say that they're worried about maintaining a certain capital level. And of course, banks don't have to worry about reserves all that much as long as they're solvent. Every solvent bank is also liquid by definition. As long as you're solvent, you can borrow. The corollary is not necessarily true. So this allows us to explain that a little bit better. And then I guess formally, the reason why I approached this, it was spurred on by the Bank of England's discussion paper in 2014, where they popularized this loans first idea of the money multiplier. And it allows you to say, yes, banks might issue loans first, but that doesn't mean that they're unconstrained in the money creation process. They're definitely constrained. It might not be through reserves, but it's through capital, which is the emphasis now on banking regulation in any case. Thanks. Thank you.